This is the LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Garrett Burt. The History of England from the Inception of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 5. On Thursday, the 2nd of July, Monmouth again entered Bridgewater. In circumstances far less cheering than those in which he had marched thence 10 days before, the reinforcement which he had found was inconsiderable. The royal army was close upon him. At one moment he thought of fortifying the town, and hundreds of laborers were summoned to dig trenches and throw up mounds. Then his mind recurred to the plan of marching into Cheshire, a plan which he had rejected as impracticable when he was at Keynsham, and which assuredly was not more practicable now that he was at Bridgewater. While he was thus wavering between projects equally hopeless, the king's forces came in sight. They consisted of about 2,500 regular troops and of about 1,500 of the Wiltshire militia. Early on the morning of Sunday, the 5th of July, they left Somerton and pitched their tents that day about 3 miles from Bridgewater on the plain of Sedgemoor. Dr. Peter Meany, Bishop of Winchester, accompanied them. This prelate had in his youth borne arms for Charles I against the Parliament. Being of his years, his profession had wholly extinguished his martial ardor, and he probably thought that the appearance of a father of a Protestant church in the king's camp might confirm the loyalty of some of the honest men who were wavering between their horror of popery and their horror of rebellion. The steeple of the parish church in Bridgewater is said to be the loftiest of Somersetshire, and commands a wide view over the surrounding country. Monmouth, accompanied by some of his officers, went up to the top of the square tower from which the spire ascends, and observed through a telescope the position of the enemy. Beneath him lay a flat expanse, now rich with cornfields and apple trees, but then, as its main imports, for the most part a dreary morass. When the rains were heavy, and the Pear and its tributary streams rose above their banks, this tract was often flooded. It was indeed anciently part of that great swamp which is renowned in our early chronicles as having arrested the progress of 2 successive races of invaders, which long protected the Celts against the aggressions of the kings of Wessex, and which sheltered Alfred from the pursuit of the Danes. In those remote times, this region could be traversed only in boats. It was a vast pool wherein were scattered many islets of shifting and treacherous soil, overhung with rank jungle and swarming with deer and wild swine. Even in the days of the Tudors, the traveler whose journey lay from Ilchester to Bridgewater was forced to make a circuit of several miles in order to avoid the waters. When Monmouth looked upon Sedgemoor, it had been partially reclaimed by art, and was intersected by many deep and wide trenches which, in that country, are called rhines. In the midst of the moor roads, clustering around towers and churches, a few villages, of which the names seem to indicate that they once were surrounded by waves. In one of these villages, called Weston Zoyland, the royal cavalry lay, and Feversham had several battalions of regular infantry. Monmouth looked gloomy among them. He could not but remember how, a few years before, he had, at the head of a column composed of some of his very men, driven before him in confusion the fierce enthusiasts who defended Bunker Bridge. He could distinguish among the hostile ranks that gallant band which was then called from the name of its colonel, Dunbarton's regiment, but which has long been known as the first of the line, and which, in all the four quarters of the world, has nobly supported its early reputation. "I know these men," said Monmouth. "They will fight. If I had but them, all would go well." Yet the aspect of the enemy was not altogether discouraging. The three divisions of the Royal Army lay far apart from one another. There was all appearance of negligence and of relaxed discipline in their movements. It was reported that day that they were drinking themselves drunk with preserve and cider. The incapacity of Feversham, who commanded in chief, was notorious. Even at this momentous crisis, he thought only of eating and sleeping. Churchill was indeed a captain equal to tasks far more arduous than that of scattering a crowd of ill-armed and ill-trained peasants. But the genius which, at a later period, humbled 6 marshals of France, was not now in its proper place. Feversham told Churchill little, and gave him no encouragement to offer any suggestion. The lieutenant